Good evening, and welcome to Boring Books for Bedtime. I hope tonight's installment provides all the boredom your busy brain needs to quiet down and let you get some sleep for once. So lie back, adjust your volume, take a nice deep breath, and off we go. This evening's selection is taken from a handbook of some South Indian grasses by R. Akariyar, Government Press, Madras, 1921. Preface. This book is intended to serve as a guide to the study of grasses of the plains of South India. For the past few years, I have been receiving grasses for identification almost every week from the officers of the Agricultural and Forest Departments and others interested in grasses. The requirements of these men and the absence of a suitable book induced me to write this book. I have included in this book about 100 grasses of wide distribution in the plains of South India. Many of them occur also in other parts of India. The rarer grasses of the plains and those growing on the hills are omitted with a view to deal with them separately. The value of grasses can be realized from the fact that man can supply all of his needs from them alone, and their importance in agriculture is very great, as the welfare of the cattle is dependent upon grasses. Farmers, as a rule, take no interest in them, although profitable agriculture is impossible without grasses. Very few of them can give the names of at least half a dozen grasses growing on their land. They neglect grasses because they are common and are found everywhere. They cannot discriminate between them. To a farmer, grass is grass, and that is all he cares to trouble himself about. About grasses, Robinson writes, quote, "Grass is king. It rules and governs the world. It is the very foundation of all commerce. Without it, the earth would be a barren waste, and cotton, gold, and commerce all dead," end quote. In the early days, when the population was very much limited, and when land not brought under cultivation was extensive, plenty of green grass was upon it, and pastures were numerous. So the farmer paid no attention to the grasses, and it did not matter much. But now population has increased. Unoccupied land has decreased very much, and the cattle have increased in number. Consequently, he has to pay more attention to grasses. On account of the scarcity of fodder, people interested in agriculture and cattle rearing have very often imported foreign grasses and fodder plants into this country. But so far, no one has succeeded in establishing any one of them on any large scale. Usually, a great amount of labor and much money is spent in these attempts. If the same amount of attention is bestowed on indigenous grasses, better results can be obtained with less labor and money. There are many indigenous grasses that will yield plenty of stuff if they are given a chance to grow. The present deterioration of grasses is mainly due to overgrazing and trampling by men and cattle. To prove the beneficial effects which result from preventing overgrazing and trampling, Mr. G. R. Hilson, Deputy Director of Agriculture and now cotton expert, selected some portion of the wasteland in the neighborhood of the farm at Hagari and closed it for men and cattle. As a result of this measure, in 2 years, a number of grasses and other plants were found growing on the enclosed area very well, and all of them seeded well. Of course, the unenclosed areas were bare, as usual. I have to express my deep obligation to Mr. G. A. D. Stewart, ICS, Director of Agriculture, for encouragement to undertake this work, and to the Madras government for ordering its publication. For the excellence in the getup of the book, I am indebted to Mr. F. L. Gilbert, Superintendent, Government Press. K. Rangakari, Agricultural College, Lawley Road, Coimbatore, 2nd of June, 1921. Chapter 1, Introduction. Grasses occupy wide tracts of land and they are evenly distributed in all parts of the world. They occur in every soil, in all kinds of situations, and under all climatic conditions. In certain places, grasses form a leading feature of the flora. As grasses do not like shade, they are not usually abundant within the forests, either as regards the number of individuals or of species. But in open places, they do very well, and sometimes whole tracts become grasslands. Then a very great portion of the actual vegetation would consist of grasses. On account of their almost universal distribution and their great economic value, grasses are of great importance to man. And yet very few people appreciate the worth of grasses. Although several families of plants supply the wants of man, the grass family exceeds all the others in the amount and the value of its products. The grasses growing in pasture land and the cereals growing all over the world are of more value to man and his domestic animals than all the other plants taken together. To the popular mind, grasses are only herbaceous plants with narrow leaves, such as the hariali, ginger grass, and the kolakati grass. But in the grass family, or graminae, the cereals, sugarcane, and bamboos are also included. Grasses are rather interesting in that they are usually successful in occupying large tracts of land to the exclusion of other plants. If we take into consideration the number of individuals of any species of grass, they will be found to outnumber those of any species of any other family. Even as regards the number of species, this family ranks fifth, the first four places being occupied respectively by Compositae, Leguminosae, Orchidiae, and Rubiaceae. As grasses form an exceedingly natural family, it is very difficult for beginners to readily distinguish them from one another. The leaves and branches of grasses are very much alike, and the flowers are so small that they are liable to be passed by unnoticed. The recognition of even our common grasses is quite a task for a botanist. To understand the general structure of grasses and to become familiar with them, it is necessary to study closely some common types of grasses. We shall begin our study by selecting as a type one of the species of the genus Panicum. Panicum javanicum is an annual herb with stems radiating in all directions from a center. The plant is fixed to the soil by a tuft of fibrous roots, all springing from the bases of the stems. In addition to this crown of fibrous roots, there may be roots at the nodes of some of the prostrate branches. The stems and branches are short at first, and leaves arise on them one after the other in rapid succession. After the appearance of a fair number of leaves, the stem elongates gradually, and it finally ends in an inflorescence. The stem consists of nodes and internodes. The internodes are cylindrical and somewhat flattened on the side towards the axillary bud. When young, they are completely covered by the leaves, and the older ones have only their lower portions covered by the leaf sheath. Usually they complete their growth and length very soon, but the lower portion of the internode, just above the node and enclosed by the sheath, retains its power of growth for some time. The leaf consists of the two parts, the leaf sheath and the leaf blade. At the junction of these two parts, there is a very thin, narrow membrane with fine hairs on its free margin. This is called the ligule. The leaf sheath is attached at its base to the node, and it is slightly swollen just above the place of insertion. It covers the internode, one margin being inside and the other outside. The surface of the sheath is sparsely covered with long hairs springing from small tubercules. The outer margin of the sheath bears fine hairs all along its length. The leaf blade is broadly lanceolate, with the tip finely drawn out. Its base is rounded and the margin wavy, especially so towards the base. On the margin towards the base, long hairs are seen, and some of these arise from small tubercles. The margin has a hyaline border, which is very minutely serrate. There is a very distinct midrib, and on holding the leaf against the light, four or five small veins come into view. In the spaces between these veins lie many fine veins. All the veins run parallel from the base to the apex. At the base of the blade, the veins get into the leaf sheath, and therefore the sheath becomes striated. Just above the ligule and at the base of the leaf blade, there is a colorless narrow zone. This is called the collar. As already stated, the inflorescences appear at the free ends of branches. Every branch, sooner or later, terminates in an inflorescence, which is a compound raceme. There are usually five or six racemes in the inflorescence. Each raceme has an axis called the rachis, which bears unilaterally two rows of bud-like bodies. These bud-like bodies are the units of the inflorescence, and they are called spikelets. The spikelets are soft, hairy, and are shortly stalked. The pedicels of spikelets are hairy, and sometimes one or two long hairs are also found on them. Each of these spikelets consists of four green membranous structures called glumes. The first two glumes are unequal, the first being very small. The second and the third glumes are broadly ovate oblong with acute tips. Both are of the same height and texture, but the second is seven-nerved and the third five-nerved. The fourth glume is membranous when young, but later on it becomes thick, coriaceous, and rugose at the surface. Just opposite to the fourth glume, there is a flat structure with two nerves, similar to the glume in texture. This is called the pilea. The fourth glume and its pilea adhere together by their margins. Inside the fourth glume and between it and the pilea, there are three stamens and an ovary with two styles ending in feathery stigmas. Just in front of the ovary and outside the stamens, two very small scale-like bodies are found. These are the lodicules. They are fleshy and well-developed in flowers that are about to open. In the spikelet, there is only one full flower. The third glume contains no flower in it, but occasionally there may be in its axil three stamens. The first two glumes are always empty, and so they are called empty glumes. In mature spikelets, the grain which is free is enclosed by the fourth glume and its pilea. Chapter 2. The Vegetative Organs. Grasses vary very much in their habit. Some grasses grow erect, forming tufts, and others form cushions with the branches creeping along the ground. We usually find all intermediate stages from the erect to the prostrate habit. Underground stems, such as stolons and rhizomes, occur in some grasses. Grasses of one particular species generally retain the same habit, but this does not always hold good. For example, Tragus racemosus grows with all its branches quite prostrate in a poor, dry, open soil. If, on the other hand, this happens to grow in rich soils or amidst other plants or grasses, it assumes an erect, somewhat tufted habit. Andropogon contortus and Andropogon pertussis are other grasses with a tendency for variation in habit. Plants that are usually small often attain large dimensions under favorable conditions of growth. Ordinarily, the grass Panicum javanicum grows only 1 or 2 feet. The same plant in a good rich soil grew to about 6 feet in 4 months. Some grasses are annual, while others are perennial. It is often difficult to determine whether a certain grass is annual or perennial, but by examining the shoot system, this can be ascertained easily. In an annual, all the stems and branches usually end in inflorescences, and they will all be of the same year. If, on the other hand, both young leafy branches and old branches ending in inflorescences are found mixed, it must be a perennial grass. the presence of the remains of old leaves, underground stolons and rhizomes is also evidence showing the perennial character of the plant. Grasses are eminently adapted to occupy completely large areas of land. They are also capable of very rapid extension over large areas on account of the production of stolons, rhizomes, and the formation of adventitious roots. The root system. The root system of grasses is very striking in its character. In most grasses, especially in erect ones, several roots, all of about the same diameter, arise in a dense tuft from nearly the same level and from the lowermost nodes of the stems. The roots are all thin and fibrous in the vast majority of these plants, and they are tough and wiry only in a few cases, such as in the case of the roots of Pennisetum chancroides, Pennisetum elapicurus, Ischimum pilosum, and Andropogon sconanthus. On a close examination, it will become evident that all the roots of a grass plant are adventitious. Inasmuch as the growth of the primary root is soon overtaken by other roots growing from the stem, all the roots happen to be of the same size. Roots arise from the nodes just above the insertion of the leaf, and they grow piercing the leaf sheath. Grasses in which stolons and prostrate branches occur have, in addition to the usual radiating crown of roots at the base, aerial roots growing out of the upper nodes of the branches and fixing them to the soil. Such roots become supporting or prop roots and are particularly conspicuous in several stout tall grasses, such as Andropogon sorghum, Zea maize, and Pennisetum typhoideum. All the roots bear branch roots, which originate from the inner portion of the mother roots in the usual manner. The character and the extent of the development of the root system is to a large extent dependent upon the nature of the soil and its moisture content. In light, dry soils, roots remain generally stunted, and in well-drained, rich soils, they attain their maximum development. In clayey soils, roots penetrate only to short distances. When the soil is rich and sandy, roots go deeper and extend in all directions. The root systems of most grasses are superficial and so are best adapted for surface feeding. The shoot system. The shoot system varies with the duration of the life of the plant. In annual grasses, stems are in most cases erect, and even if they are not entirely so, they become erect at the time of flowering. They are attached to the soil by a tuft of fibrous roots arising from the base of the stems. But in perennials, in addition to erect branches, creeping branches, stolons, and rhizomes may occur. The stem is either cylindrical or compressed and consists of nodes and internodes. In most grasses, the internodes are usually hollow, the cavity being lined by the remains of the original pith cells. However, there are also grasses in which the stems remain solid throughout. In many grasses, the basal portions of stems are more leafy and the internodes are short, but in the upper portions, the internodes become longer, separating the leaves one from the other. In young shoots, the leaves grow much faster than the internodes, and consequently, internodes remain small, and leaves become very conspicuous. The youngest portions of the shoots are by this means always well protected by the surrounding leaf sheaths. As soon as leaves have grown fully, the internodes begin to elongate rapidly, separating the leaves. At first, growth in length takes place throughout its length in the internode, and when it gets older, this elongation ceases. But, however, the lower portion of the internode close to the node, and which is enclosed by the leaf sheath, retains its powers of growth for a considerable time. Branches arise from the axils of leaves, and when a considerable number of the axillary buds, especially from the lower nodes, develop into branches, the plants become tufted in habit. In most grasses, branches grow upwards through the sheath and emerge at its mouth as aerial branches. Such branches are called intravaginal branches or stems. But in some grasses, axillary buds, instead of growing straight up through the sheath, pierce the leaf sheath, come out, and then they grow out as branches. This may be seen in the underground stolons of Panicum repens and in the ordinary aerial branches of Arundodonax. Branches that pierce through the sheaths are called extravaginal branches. The nodes are in most cases very conspicuous, and they are often found swollen. However, it must be remembered that the enlargement of the node is not due to the increase in size of the actual node, but due to growth in thickness of the base of the leaf sheath. Nodes may be pale or colored, glabrous, hairy, or bearded with long hairs. When the stem is erect, the nodes are short and of uniform size all around. But if the stem is bent down or tipped over by accident, the nodes begin to grow longer on the lower side until a curvature sufficient to bring the stem to the erect position is formed, and then it ceases to grow. As already noted, some perennial grasses have creeping stems and stolons, while others may have rhizomes. The grass Cynodontodactylon develops several underground stolons which are covered with white scale leaves and whose terminal buds are hard and sharp so that they may be able to make their way through the soil. The rhizomes, when continuous and elongated, are usually sympodia, formed by the lower portions of the aerial shoots. The aerial shoot comes into the air, and its lower portion is continued by a branch arising from a lower leaf axil beneath the soil. The leaf. Leaves are two-ranked and alternate, and very often they become crowded at the lower portions of the shoots so as to form basal tufts, though they are farther apart in the upper portions of these shoots. Three distinct kinds of leaves are met with in grasses. First, we have the fully formed foliage leaves, so characteristic of grasses. These are the most conspicuous and are formed in large numbers. The other two kinds of leaves are neither so conspicuous nor so numerous as the foliage leaves. At the base of shoots occur abortive leaves, which are really rudimentary sheaths. These are called scales. The third kind of leaf is a modified structure called the profil or profilum. It is the first leaf occurring in every branch on the side next to the main shoot, and it is a two-keeled membranous structure resembling somewhat the pilea found in the spikelets of grasses. The portion of the profil between the keels is concave due to the pressure of the main stem, while the sides beyond the keels bend forward, clasping the stem. The ordinary foliage leaves of grasses consist of the two parts, the flat, expanded upper portion called the blade, and the lower part called the sheath that encircles the stem above the node from which it arises. The leaf sheaths usually fit close to the stem, but they may also be loose or even inflated. Though the leaf sheath surrounds the internode like a tube, it is not a closed tube. It is really a flat structure rolled firmly around the stem, with one edge overlapping the other. In most cases, it is cylindrical, and it may be compressed in a few cases. Occasionally, it may have a prominent ridge or keel down its back. The sheath may be glabrous or hairy, smooth or striate externally, and the outer margin is often ciliate. In a few grasses, the sheaths become colored, especially below or on the side exposed to the sun. The ligule is a structure peculiar to grasses, and it varies very much. In some grasses, it is a distinct membrane, narrow or broad, with an even, truncate, or erose margin, or finely ciliate. Very often, it is only a line or fringe of hairs, whilst in some it may be entirely absent, as in the leaves of Panicum colinum. When it is a membrane, it may be broad and oblong, ovate and obtuse, or lanceolate and acute. The function of the ligule is probably to facilitate the shedding of water which may run down the leaf, and thus lessen the danger of rotting of the stem which is sure to follow if the water were to find its way into the interior of the sheath. Sometimes, in addition to the ligule, other appendages may be present in grass leaves, as in Oryza sativa. Such outgrowths are called auricles or auricular outgrowths. The leaf blade is well developed in the foliage leaves, and in most cases it follows directly on the sheath. But in bamboos and some species of ischimum, there occurs a short petiole or stalk between the leaf blade and the sheath. The sheath corresponds morphologically to the leaf base of a leaf of other flowering plants. In grasses, the leaf blades usually grow more in length than in any other direction, and there is no limit to the length they may attain. Some grasses have very short leaves, others very long ones. The leaf blade in most grasses is more or less of some elongated form, such as linear, linear lanceolate, lanceolate, etc. In a few grasses, the leaf blade is ovate, but this is a rare condition. Therefore, in noting the general shape of the leaf blade, the relation of the length to the breadth, the amount of tapering towards the apex and base, and the nature of the apex should be considered. The veins in the leaf blade can usually be seen on holding the leaf up to the light. All the veins run parallel. In most cases, the midrib is prominent, and in some cases, there may also be a distinct keel. Amongst the veins running through the leaf blade, some are large and prominent, while others are small and not conspicuous. On account of this disparity, very often ridges and furrows become prominent on the upper or lower, or on both the surfaces of the leaf blades. Generally, the two surfaces of the leaf blade are distinct, and they may be glabrous or hairy. In most grasses, the surfaces are rough or scabrous to the touch, owing to the presence of regular rows of exceedingly fine, sharp, pointed, minute hairs. The apex of the blade is generally sharp and pointed, acute or acuminate, or sometimes it may be drawn to a very fine point by gradual tapering. Blunt or obtuse tips are not altogether absent, but it is not a common feature. The leaf blades in Panicum colinum and in some species of Andropogon are rounded or obtuse at the apex. The margins of the leaf blade are somewhat hyaline, and they may be perfectly even or cut into serrations of fine teeth in various ways. In addition to these minute teeth, there may be long or short cilia. Sometimes the margins are glandular, as in Aerogrostis wildenoviana and Aerogrostis major. The base of the leaf may be narrower, broader than, or about the same as the breadth of the leaf sheath. It may be rounded, amplexical, or narrowed. At the base and just above the ligular region, there will always be a white distinct zone in the lamina of all grasses called the collar. This collar varies in length and breadth according to the species of grass. In young shoots, all the leaf blades are usually found folded at the terminal points. In most cases, the leaf blade is rolled up inwards from one end to the other so that one margin is inside and the other outside. This folding is termed convolute. This is the kind of folding that is found in most grasses. However, there are some grasses, such as Eleusine aegyptica and Chloris barbata, in which the folding is different. In these grasses, the laminas are folded flat on their midribs, so that each half of the blade is folded flat on the other, the inner surfaces being in contact. The leaves are said to be conduplicate in this case. When the leaves are conduplicate, the shoots are more or less compressed. Chapter 3, The Inflorescence and Flower. The flowers of grasses are reduced to their essential organs, the stamens and the pistil. The flowers are aggregated together on distinct shoots, constituting the inflorescence of grasses. Sooner or later, all the branches of a grass plant terminate in inflorescences, which usually stand far above the foliage leaves. As in other flowering plants, in grasses, also different forms of inflorescence are met with. But in grasses, the unit of the inflorescence is the spikelet and not the flower. The forms of inflorescence usually met with are the spike, raceme, and panicle. When the spikelets are sessile, or borne directly along an elongated axis, as in Enteropogon melicoides, the inflorescence is a spike. If the spikelets borne by the axis are all stalked, however short the pedicles may be, it is a raceme. It must, however, be remembered that true spikes are very rare. An inflorescence may appear to be a spike, but on a close examination, it will be seen to consist of spikelets, more or less pedicled. Such an inflorescence, strictly speaking, is a spiciform raceme. The branches of the inflorescence in Paspalum scorbiculatum or Panicum javanicum are racemes, and the whole inflorescence is a compound raceme. The inflorescence is a panicle when the spikelets are borne on secondary, tertiary, or further subdivided branches. Panicles differ very much in appearance according to the relative length and stoutness of the branches. In Erigrostis tremula, the panicle is very diffuse. In Erigrostis waldenoviana, less so. The panicle in Spirobolus coromandelianus is pyramidal, and the branches are all verticillate, the lower being longer than the upper. The branches of a panicle are usually loose, spreading or drooping in most grasses. But in some species of grasses, such as Pennisetum alipicurus and Setaria glauca, the paniculate inflorescences become so contracted that the pedicels and the short branches are hidden, and the inflorescence appears to be a spike. Such inflorescences as these are called spiciform panicles. The inflorescences in several species of Andropogon consist of racemes so much modified as to appear exactly like a spike. What looks like a spike in these cases consists of a jointed axis, and each joint bears a pair of spikelets, one sessile and the other pedicled. The name rachis is given to the axis of the spike, raceme, and panicle, whether the axis is the main one or of the branch. The rachis of the inflorescence is usually cylindrical. In some grasses, it is zigzag, as in Pennisetum chancroides. It is very much flattened in Paspalum scorbiculatum, but somewhat trigonous in Digitaria sanguinalis. In very many grasses, the rachis is continuous, but in a few cases, it consists of internodes or joints which disarticulate at maturity. Many species of Andropogon have such jointed rachices. Sometimes the joints become greatly thickened and the surface hollowed out, the spikelets fitting in the cavities, as in Rotbolia and Menosaurus. In panicles, especially when they are diffuse, the primary branches may be disposed irregularly or in verticils on the main axis. For example, in the panicle of Erigrostis waldenoviana, the branches are irregularly disposed, whereas in Sporobolus coromandelianus, the branches are verticillate. In both these grasses, fleshy cushions are developed in the axils of the branches. These swellings help to spread out the branches, especially at the time of anthesis. The branches at the top spread out earlier than those below. Sometimes at the base of the rachices, main or secondary, glandular streaks are seen, as in the rachices of Spirobolus coromandelianus. These glands secrete a viscid juice at the time of anthesis. The spikelet may be considered as a specialized branch consisting of a short axis, the rachilla bearing a series of modified bracts, the glumes, the lower pair being empty, but the others bearing flowers in their axils. The glumes are two-ranked and imbricating. As a type for the spikelet, that of an Erigrostis or Denebra may be chosen. In this spikelet, the rachilla bears a number of glumes alternating and imbricating. The first two glumes at the base of the spikelet do not bear any flowers, and so these two glumes are usually called empty glumes. This is the case in almost all the species of grasses. The third and the subsequent glumes are regularly arranged on the slender rachilla, alternately in two rows. In the axils of each of these glumes, there is a flower, except perhaps in the topmost glume. The flower is usually enclosed by the glume, and another structure found opposite the glume and differing very much from the glume. This is the pilea. It is attached to the axis of the flower, and its back is towards the rachilla. Generally, there are two nerves in a pilea, and its margins are enclosed within those of the glume. The pilea is homologous with the prophyllum, which it very much resembles. The prophyllum is usually found in the branches of grasses, but it is not confined to grasses alone. It occurs in the branches of some species of Comelina. The spikelets vary very much in their structure. The spikelets in grasses of several genera consist of only four glumes. As usual, the first two glumes are empty, and the remaining two are flower-bearing glumes. Both these glumes may have perfect flowers, as in Isachne, or the terminal one may contain a perfect flower, the lower having either a staminate flower or only a pilea. Very often, the spikelets are unisexual, and the male and female spikelets may be on the same plant, as in Coix lacrymajobi and Polytocha barbata. Or they may be on different plants, as in Spinifex squarosus. The glumes of a spikelet are really modified bracts, and some differentiate the flowering glumes from the empty ones by giving them different names. The first two empty glumes are called glumes by all agrostoologists. Some in Europe call the flowering glume lower pilea to distinguish it from the real pilea, which they call the upper pilea. Some American authors have recently adopted for the flowering glume the term lemma, introduced by Piper. Considerable variation is met with in the case of the empty glumes. Generally, they are unequal, the first being smaller. Very often, the first glume becomes very small, and it may be altogether absent. In some species of Panicum, the first glume is very small. In Digitaria, it is very minute, and in Paspalum and Areoglua, it is entirely suppressed. The flowering glumes are generally uniform when there are many. In the spikelet having only four glumes, the fourth glume differs from the others mainly in texture. Instead of being thin and herbaceous, it becomes rigid and hard, smooth or rugose externally, as in Panicum. Flowering glumes, instead of being like empty glumes, become very thin, shorter, and hyaline in Andropogon. Sometimes, the flowering glumes are awned. All of them may be awned, as in Chloris, or only the fourth glume, as in Andropogon. The pilea is fairly uniform in its structure in many grasses, but it is also subject to variation. It becomes shorter in some and is absent in others. Instead of having two nerves, it may have only one, and rarely more than two. The pilea can easily be distinguished from the glume because its insertion in the spikelet is different from that of the glume. The lodicules are small organs, and they are the vestiges of the perianth. In most grasses, there are only two, but in Oaklandra and other bamboos, we meet with three lodicules. There are also some species with many lodicules. In shape, they are mostly of some form referable to the cuneate form. They are of somewhat elongated form in Aristida and Chloris. The function of the loticules seems to be to separate the gloom and its pilea so as to enable the stamens to come out and hang freely at the time of anthesis. So it is only at the time of the opening of the flowers that the loticules are at their best. Then they are fairly large, fleshy, and thick and conspicuous. In the bud stage, they are usually small, and after the opening of the flower, they shrivel up and are inconspicuous. There are also species of grasses in which the loticules are not found. The stamens are 3 in number in the majority of grasses, and 6 are met with in Lyrsia, Hygrorrhiza, and bamboos. Each stamen consists of a very delicate long filament and an anther basafixed to the filament. But as the anthers are long and the connective is reduced to its minimum, they appear as if versatile when the stamens are out. When there are 3 stamens, one stands in front of the flowering glumes and the other 2 in front of the pilea, one opposite each edge of the pilea. The relative position of the parts of the floret are shown in the floral diagrams. The pistil consists of an ovary and 2 styles ending in plumose stigmas. The ovary is 1-celled and 1-ovuled. It is 1-carpeled according to the views of Haeckel and his followers, and there are also some who consider it as 3-carpeled because of the occurrence of 3 styles in the pistil of some bamboos. The rachilla is usually well-developed and elongated in many flowered spikelets, while in 1-flowered spikelets, it remains very small so that the flower appears to be terminal. It often extends beyond the insertion of the terminal flower and its gloom, and then lies hidden, oppressed to the pilea. This may be seen in the spikelets of the species of Kynodon. This prolonged rachilla sometimes bears a minute gloom, which is, of course, rudimentary. Usually the glooms are rather close together on the rachilla, so that the internodes are very short. But in some grasses, as in Denebra arabica, the glooms are rather distant, and so the internodes are somewhat longer and conspicuous. In some species of Panicum, the rachilla is jointed to the pedicel below the empty glooms, whereas it is articulated just above these glooms in Chloris barbata. Sometimes the rachilla is articulated between the flowers. This is the case of the spikelet of Denebra arabica. Pollination in most grasses is brought about by wind, though in a few cases self-pollination occurs. The terminal position of the inflorescence, its protrusion far above the level of the foliage leaves, the swinging and dangling anthers, the abundance of non-sticking pollen, and the plumose stigmas are all intended to facilitate pollination by wind. Furthermore, the stamens and the stigmas do not mature at the same time. In some grasses, the stamens mature earlier, protandry, while in others, the stigmas protrude long before the stamens, protogeny. As the result of the pollination, the ovary develops into a dry, one-seeded, indehiscent fruit. The seed fills the cavity fully, and the pericarp fuses with the seed coat, and so they are inseparable. Such a fruit is termed a caryopsis, or grain. Though in the vast majority of grasses, the pericarp is inseparable, in a few cases it is free from the seed coat, as in Spirobolus indicus and Eleusine indica. The caryopsis consists of an embryo on one side of the base, and the endosperm occupies the remaining portion. The embryo can be made out of the side of the grain facing the gloom, as it is outlined as an oval area. On the other face of the grain, which is towards the pilea, the hilum is seen at the base. The grain varies in shape considerably. It may be rounded, oval, ellipsoidal, narrow and cylindrical, oblong terete, or furrowed. There is considerable variation as regards the color also. The embryo consists of an axis and a scutellum. The axis, which is differentiated into the plumule directed upward and the radicle downward, is small and straight, and it is covered more or less by the edges of the scutellum. The scutellum is attached to the axis at about its middle, and its outer surface is in contact with the endosperm. This is an important organ, as its function is to absorb nourishment from the endosperm during germination. The scutellum is considered to represent the first leaf, or cotyledon. The endosperm consists mostly of starch. Just outside the endosperm, and within the epidermis, lies a layer of cells containing much proteid matter. This layer is called the alurone layer. As an illustration of the caryopsis, the grain of Andropogon sorghum may be studied. All the structural details are shown in a longitudinal section of the grain. The primary axis of the embryo is enclosed by a closed sheath both above and below. The sheath which envelops the radicle is called coleorrhiza, and that of the plumule, pileole, or germ sheath. Well, I'd say that's enough of that, don't you think? I'm very bored indeed, and that was a lot of Latin. Have we even gotten to the Indian grasses? I'm not actually sure. Hopefully, you're no longer awake to hear this. But if you are, and you'd still like something to do, please consider leaving us a positive review on iTunes. It's very helpful. Or check in with us on Twitter at BoringBooksPod to suggest a reading or leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time.